Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
It's on!
Hi, everyone. From New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is On with Kara Swisher, and I'm Kara Swisher. My guest today is writer and director Cord Jefferson. His first feature film, American Fiction, has been nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. American Fiction is a satire about a black college professor and a writer named Monk Ellison who can't get his latest book published because it's not deemed, quote, black enough. As a big fuck you to the book industry, he writes an over-the-top ghetto novel called My Pathology, yes, that's right, My Pathology, full of black stereotypes under a pseudonym. And the editors eat it up, especially after the writer claims that he is a wanted fugitive.
You'll notice that our offer is unusually large, and that is because we believe Mr. Lee has written a bestseller. We think it is going to be the read of the summer.
Yeah, I'm sure white people on the Hamptons will delight in it.
Yeah, we will. It's going to be huge. Huge.
The New York Times calls American Fiction, quote, a layered send-up of race and hypocrisy in the book and film worlds. Variety says it pokes, quote, fun at how Hollywood and others attempt to commercialize the African-American experience. And they're not wrong. But to me, American Fiction is about a lot more than that, especially complicated family dynamics, fighting with your siblings and ailing parents. It's incredibly relatable, and that's the point. Cord Jefferson started his career as a journalist, then shifted to television writing. He worked on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore, Succession, The Good Place, and Master of None. He won an Emmy for an episode of The Watchmen. Not too long ago, I had a lunch with him in Los Angeles and was just riveted by his career trajectory. Our question this week comes from Succession creator Jesse Armstrong. I also did the Succession podcast, and Cord did work on that show, which was, of course, a giant HBO hit. I want to talk to Cord about the film and his writing career, and I want to get his thoughts about the use of AI in Hollywood and how it could impact efforts like American Fiction to tell richer stories. We'll talk about all that and more coming up. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. People say perfect is the enemy of good, but simple is everyone's best friend because when something is simple and easy, it tends to work out for the best. And NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for your business. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/on, netsuite.com/on, netsuite.com/on.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this show comes from Virgin Atlantic. Travel can be stressful. I don't think that's a controversial take. Sure, we all love taking a vacation and that moment we finally get a chance to relax, but we're always so focused on the destination that the journey just feels like a means to an end. Well, what if it wasn't? What if the time you spent getting there was just as enjoyable as the vacation itself? That's what Virgin Atlantic believes. That's why they offer loads of special extra touches that make your trip one to remember for all the best reasons. Picture this, you made it to the airport, checked in your bags, and finally have a moment to settle in before takeoff. If you're flying upper class, you could be putting your feet up in a Virgin Atlantic clubhouse at London Heathrow with food made fresh to order and champagne delivered straight to your table with a tap of a QR code. I mean, it's rude not to, right? Once you're in the air, the experience continues with deliciously different dining, seriously comfy seats, and the best crew in the sky by miles. Check out virginatlantic.com for your next trip and see the world differently. Court, thanks for joining us. How are you doing? It's been a busy couple of months for you.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Things have been great. To say that I'm overwhelmed, I think, is an understatement. But I'm doing as well as I can in all of it. I'm trying to enjoy the ride as much as possible.
You are. Last time we met, I think you were working for Succession. We had lunch in Santa Monica with Amina. I think that was correct.
That was probably. Well, I may have just gotten back from Succession to work on Watchmen. That was probably 2018.
Watchmen. That was it.
Close to 6 years ago. Yeah. Wow.
I know. And you hadn't mentioned this movie. I really love this film. It was both a surprise and also it was clear it was going to be, you're such a smart writer, but you wrote a screenplay based on the book Erasure by Percival Everett.
Correct.
Do you remember where you were in that book when you realized I need to make this a movie?
Yeah. About 50 pages in. It was very, very early into the read. I don't know if you've ever had this feeling, but it felt like somebody had written a novel specifically for me. Like somebody sat down and said, I'm writing a gift for Cord Jefferson. That's how deeply the material resonated with me. And nothing has resonated with me deeper before or since. And so it just felt like kismet. I was at a weird time in my life. I was sort of like down in the dumps professionally. It was COVID. It was the beginning.
What year was this? COVID.
December of 2020. Mm-hmm. So like obviously everybody had a bad year, but I also had my biggest professional failure of my life that year. And so I was
what was that?
I was making a show for Apple and we were so close to getting it on the air that they were telling me where the production offices were going to be in Brooklyn when we started shooting. That's how confident everybody was that the show was going to get on the air. And then they pulled the plug at the last minute. And so that was September, October of 2020. And so I was just feeling really creatively adrift, didn't know what I was going to do for my next creative project. And I was just picking up a book to read for fun over the holidays.
Got it yourself at the bookstore?
No, I was reading a book review actually for a different book called Interior Chinatown. And that book review said that it referenced Erasure as having a similar style of satire. And so I had never heard of Erasure and I went and read a synopsis. And it sounded intriguing, and so I bought it, and with no auspices, just read it because I was looking for a new thing to read over the holidays, and instantly fell in love.
Mm-hmm. So you started making it. You started creating the screenplay, or what was the next move?
The next move, well, I didn't want to write anything until we'd found out if the rights were available. So the next move is going to the author to find out if the rights are available. They were, but Percival Everett, who wrote the novel, you know, he was a little cagey. He said no to people in the past about getting the rights for this book, I was told. And so they said he wanted to speak with me on the phone. And so Percival and I had a phone call for about a half an hour. And he just asked me about myself, my background, the stuff that I'd worked on. And then He asked me, you know, who I thought I might want to cast in the movie. Sort of, he asked me, I think, about the tone that I was going for. And then after about a half an hour, we hung up. And later that day, I found out that he was willing to give me the rights for free for 6 months. He said, he said that if anything came of it, if anything came of the script, that I could pay him back once we'd sold the script. And, you know, that if anybody knows about these things, that is...
Yeah.
Just sometimes the rights negotiations can take months or years for things like this. And so, yeah, the fact that he gave it to me for free and just said, go write, that was a huge blessing for me. And I asked him afterward why, and he said he thought it was clear that I understood the essence of the novel, the point of what he was getting at. And so that
I love a quirky novelist. I love a quirky novelist.
Me too. I'll take
which,
it all day.
Which you write about, by the way, which is what the movie's about, that. And, you know, a writer, a quirky writer. But it's about a lot of things, American Fiction. When you first took this, the studios as your first feature film, what did you describe it as? Because it's sort of, it's a box in a box in a box. I think it's more about families than anything else. That's what I took away.
Absolutely.
But how did you bring it to the studio?
I mean, I think that the way that we sold it was leaning into the satire. You know, I think that was what we knew was going to be the best sales tool for the project, was just leaning into the comedy, leaning into the satire of the whole thing, and then kind of slipping in the sort of family stuff as a, you know, not a secret, but just kind of, you know, as going to be sort of like the icing on the cake, you know, that would sort of like just be a bonus. And I think that to me, I think that a lot of people, when we were talking about it, maybe saw the family stuff as a hindrance to the project, actually sort of like wanted more satire. And I think that actually, now that the movie's out and we've gotten a lot of feedback from people, it's, you know, I can't imagine this movie without the family stuff being what it was. I can't imagine this movie if it was just a pure comedy and you stripped away the family stuff. I think that would, or pure satirical comedy about a novelist in his profession, I think that would diminish the movie a lot in my mind if we were to have done that. Yeah.
Yeah. But the main character, American Fiction, Monk, is a writer. He's played by Jeffrey Wright, my absolute favorite actor of all times for years and years and years now. Oddly enough, I saw him in and Paul Giamatti in Ides of March, which is not a very good movie. They popped up and I'm like, oh, look at you two. And they're acting the hell out of it, but it doesn't matter. They're good in everything they do. You've talked about the overlap with your own life. Was that part of your attraction to Monk? Talk about the similarities or differences.
Yeah. That's what spoke to me so deeply, was that as I was reading the book, it just sort of the Venn diagram between Monk's life and my life started to become a circle the more that I read the book. It was started to feel like kismet, truly. I don't really like to think in spiritual terms, but or sort of like fate, but this feels, it felt serendipitous. You know, before I started working in film and television, I was a journalist for about 8 or 9 years.
You were.
And toward the end of my journalism career, I wrote this essay called The Racism Beat. I published it in 2014. It was the year that I started working in TV. And The Racism Beat was about how I had reached this point in my career when it felt like on a weekly basis, somebody was coming to me and saying, do you want to write about Trayvon Martin being killed? Or do you want to write about Mike Brown being killed? Or do you want to write about, you know, insert black teenager's name being killed by the police? Or do you want to write about this racist thing that somebody said about President Obama? And it felt like, A, spiritually degrading. That's sort of like not a fun job to have, is just to sort of like write about misery all the time. But then B, it felt like, what can I write about this that I didn't write last week when this happened, or the week before when this happened? You know, what more do you want me to say? Like, what can I write about this that somebody didn't write about when this happened with Amadou Diallo, right, in the 90s, or the sort of like even centuries before that? So just felt like I need to get out of this revolving door of tragedy and trauma. And so when I started working in film and TV, I felt like, great, this is going to be a wonderful transition, because we're not beholden to any realities of the world. We are able to write about anybody doing anything we want. It's fiction, it's fantasy. And it wasn't long, however, before I started getting offers to, do you want to write about this movie about a black teenager being killed by the police? Do you want to write this movie about
a slave? Oh, totally. The trope.
Do you want to write this movie?
When you're an actor, would you like to become a drug dealer, et cetera?
Exactly.
You know, on a very lesser level, when I was an early journalist, everyone was like, what do gay people think, Kara? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. Like, we're not meeting this week.
Yeah.
You know, it was fascinating. Would you like a response? I was like, no. Let me consult. We'll get our, you know, the lesbians will get our toaster ovens together and we'll discuss. And, like, it was ridiculous. But let me just say, I did read that essay because it resonates with anyone who, of course. I want you to read a passage from it, if you would.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I anticipate that I'll always write about race and racism in some professional capacity. Still, wouldn't it be wonderful if writers and creatives on the periphery were welcomed in from anonymity, not thanks to their accounts of woe, but simply because they have things to share, tales of love, joy, happiness, and basic humanity that have nothing to do with their race and also everything to do with their race. I'm ready for people in positions of power at magazines and newspapers and movie studios to recalibrate their understanding of what it means to talk about race in the first place. If America would like to express that it truly values and appreciates the voices of its minorities, it will listen to all their stories, not just the ones reacting to its shortcomings and brutality.
You wrote that in 2014. I will say you were a very good journalist, as I recall.
This feels like an
excellent journalist, actually.
Thank you.
It feels like a vision board for American fiction, to use an Oprah term.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that recalibration has happened?
No, I don't think it has. So I think that I am an optimist in many ways, and that I think that, you know, that I think that the world is getting better all the time as it relates to issues of identity and race. That being said, I think that we have a long, long way to go. I think that Hollywood has gotten better. You know, the fact that the reality is that there was a couple companies that gave me millions of dollars for this film. You know what I mean? That is the reality. There's another reality that 98% of the companies that we took this film to passed on it and said, we don't want to have anything to do with it, despite the fact that they were effusively praising the film and effusively sort of like saying that it's, you know, that they loved the script and that they loved Jeffrey Wright. And yet they still, it was too risky for them to tell this story. And so, you know, I think that it is getting better, but I think that if you were to sort of like look at the stories that are still primarily about people of color and other minorities, queer people, I think that you would still find that there is a lot of misery born out there, and sort of like this idea that we are defined by our ability to withstand pain and our ability to withstand prejudice and our ability to withstand abuse, and that sort of like those kinds of stories, that rigid, narrow perspective of what our lives look like, that are the only stories worth telling. So yes, I think that the fact that my story with this movie, American Fiction, was able to be made and sort of like got the support that it has is absolutely wonderful. And I don't want to deny that there are changes happening, but for the most part, you know,
hasn't changed. Yeah. Although the lesbians are having a good time in Mean Girls, even though it's just, you don't know that it's them. Anyway, one scene that really stands out for people who haven't seen the film, in the beginning, publishers say Monk's books aren't black enough, but in the bookstore, his novels are with African-American studies, which was just cringe in the best of possible ways. So he sits down in a brown leather chair, a glass of whiskey in his hand, in his father's study with diplomas on the wall. The set is excellent, very upper middle class, very Mad Men.
Yeah.
And starts to write. It was a wonderful set. My pathology.
We had a wonderful production designer. That's all I wanted to say.
100%.
Jonathan Guggenheim. He's amazing.
Yeah. But he starts to write it with ghetto stereotypes, and the characters appear in the room, which is a wonderful way of doing this.
Look at my face. Look at my midnight black complexion. No, that's not right. Huh? But what did you want to say? You can say it better than that. But, right? Come on. What do you want? Think about it, Van Gogh. Look at my face. Look at my cold black skin, and then look at your own. Look at my black eyes, and look at your own. Look at my big black lips, and look at your own. How's your daddy, whether you like it or not?
Shut up!
Talk a little bit about the scene. It was over the top in the best of ways. Explain how you thought about
that. Thanks, yeah. So in Erasure, in the actual Percival Everett novel, the character Monk writes this fake novel he writes a real novel, but he intends it to be performance art. He wants it to be sort of full of ghetto stereotypes to kind of embarrass the publishers who buy this kind of writing. And so in the book, Erasure, the entirety of that book is published. So there's a full novel within the novel that gives you really sort of like 110 pages of like the depravity that's really in this book. And
yeah.
It really makes you lean forward because you understand like how crazy this is that this is published. And so I knew that we couldn't show the entirety of the novel in the film. And so it's like the question is, how do you make writing cinematic? I sort of find that very frequently scenes of writers are not cinematic. Everybody's seen the sort of like writer punching at his keyboard furiously taking a big sip of coffee and then punching again. And
and
just knew that that would be boring to see words coming up on a computer screen. It's that nobody sort of gets excited about that kind of scene. And so I thought, what's a way to get the audience to lean forward in their seats a little bit the way that I leaned forward in my seat a little bit when I was reading the book? And it felt like, okay, what if we actually just manifested these characters? And what if, you know, and writing for me has never been a fast process. Writing for me has always been slow and painful and methodical. And I rethink and sort of like go back all the time and change things. And so I felt like, what's a way to show that while also having sort of like these characters come in front of Monk and show the audience exactly what it is that he's writing.
What they might look like.
And so we got some tremendous actors. We got Keith David, who's a legend in his own right. And then Oki, who's a fantastic Broadway performer from Hamilton. And they just came in and knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But Monk loathes the whole thing, this book. But there are two women that push back against the idea. One is writer Santara Golden, played by Issa Rae. She's fantastic. The other is his girlfriend, Coraline, played by Erica Alexander. I want to play a clip from the scene with her when he realizes she's read the book, not knowing it's his, of course.
What's this?
My friend got it for me. Have you read it?
Of course not. Have you?
Yeah.
What'd you think of it?
I liked it.
What did you like about it? It didn't offend you?
You just said you didn't read it. What's your problem?
No, you answer my question.
You answer mine.
My problem is that books like this aren't real. They flatten our lives.
What do you mean?
I mean that you know, my life is a disaster, but not in the way you'd think reading this shit. These things reduce us, and they do it over and over again because too many white people and people apparently like you devour this slop like pigs at a dumpster to stay current at fucking cocktail parties or whatever.
Okay, you got a lot of opinions for someone who hasn't published anything for years.
So talk about, this is wonderful writing and wonderful acting. So what's going on here from your perspective? Because I kind of agree with her in a weird way.
I don't think that's a weird way. I think that that's normal. I think that what we are seeing is Monk is a person who's built up a facade in front of himself, and he's very much isolated himself, and he's not telling anybody the truth. And what's happening in this scene is his girlfriend, who's a wonderful, smart lawyer, who's really sort of ebullient in a way that Monk is not, has read this novel that he intended to write as a hoax, sort of like as a piece of performance art. And now she's telling him that she likes it. And he was writing it to make a fool out of people and sort of like filled it with all these stereotypes to shame everybody. And so all of a sudden, this woman that he has deep feelings for is telling him that she enjoyed it, and it's frustrating for him. And I think that the thing that's important to remember is that just because, you know, for instance, like I love Boys in the Hood. I think that's a wonderful movie. Is it about sort of...
Santara says the same thing. Her book is based on real
interviews. Exactly.
He's very upper middle class and doesn't relate to his own characters.
Yeah. But I also think that something that sort of like... Something that happens kind of in that scene with Santara is that when they sort of talk about it at the end is she doesn't say it directly. She says it kind of glancingly. But she says something to Monk where Monk says, I think I see the potential of black people in this country.
I mean, I'm not saying these things aren't real, but we're also more than this. And it's like so many writers like you can't envision us without some white boot on our necks.
Do you get angry at Bret Easton Ellis or Charles Bukowski for writing about the downtrodden? Or is your ire strictly reserved for black women?
Nobody reads Bukowski thinking his is the definitive white experience, but people, white people, read your book and confine us to it. They think that we're all like that.
Then it sounds like your issue is with white people, Monk, not me.
Well, maybe, but I also think that I see the unrealized potential of black people in this country.
Potential is what people see when they think what's in front of them isn't good enough.
That is a glancing reference to the fact that maybe Monk is a little self-loathing. Maybe he's got a sort of like little bit of work to do with his own relationship to his blackness and sort of like black people in America in general. And so I think that what you're seeing there is when Monk is sort of so frustrated by the fact that his girlfriend likes this book is maybe that he's sort of like feeling a little bit of self-loathing and feeling a little bit of resentment.
Sure. Now, you've said that you and Jeffrey Wright had a conversation about not wanting this movie to be about respectability politics. Can you talk about this? Because it feels like this scene calls Monk out in that way in terms of how characters are depicted. Talk about the idea of respectability politics.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the term talented tenth?
No, you know this? I'm not. No.
So Talented Tenth was this. It was W.B. Du Bois used to write about it. He didn't coin the term, but he wrote about it. And the Talented Tenth is this idea that 10% of black people are going to be the ones who lift the other 90% out of sort of misery. It's sort of going to be, it's going to be up to the 10% who are truly gifted to help everybody else. And so I think that sort of like a more modern reference would be like Bill Cosby telling everybody to pull up your pants.
Or Don Lemon, yeah.
Exactly. Stop sagging your pants, stop listening to rap music, and white people will take you more seriously.
Finally treat you correctly. Yeah,
exactly. And so I think that the thing that I wanted to make sure we didn't do in this movie was that. I didn't want to shame any black people. I didn't want to shame any black artists. I have no interest in that conversation. And so to me, it was incredibly important to not villainize people who made that kind of work or people who enjoyed that kind of work, because that to me is sort of a truly sort of pointless exercise. To me, the more important thing that I think the sort of movie, the more important question that the movie tries to ask, hopefully, is why are the people atop the institutions that make movies, that make television, that make books, that publish these things, why are they so interested in repeating these stories over and over and over again? That to me is sort of like a better question. Why are the people with their hands on the purse strings interested in telling slave stories ad nauseum?
Yeah, that's true. You know, it reminds me a lot of, again, just not to make the link with gays, is that a lot of gays got mad when drag queens were in parades. Like, let's not have them here. They'll like us if we get married and look like them.
Yeah.
I was always like, they'll never fucking like us. Sorry.
Yeah.
Until we take it from them, you know?
And that was a real growth moment for me. Hey, I don't think you should, I think you should stop apologizing for sort of making the connection to gays, because I think that that's the thing about this film is this is a movie, yes, about a black novelist and a black family, but this is applicable to so many different,
That's correct.
I'm from Arizona. And I have a lot of Mexican friends from Arizona who say, you know, why does every movie set in Mexico have to be about drug cartels or about some sort of like poor person fleeing their miserable circumstances in their small town to come to the United States of America? Why does every movie or TV show shot in Mexico have this weird burnt sienna sort of like dusty like glow about everything?
Exactly.
And so I think that this is so, and yes,
guitar
I think that,
strumming somewhere.
Exactly. And so I just I think that there is an equivalent to this. But then it was a real growth moment in my life as a creative person when I stopped blaming other people sort of like on the ground. I think that it's very, very difficult for me these days to get angry at individual actors, because I sort of like realize in any sort of like arena, but I think sort of like especially art is like these artists are making art in institutions and societies that were created generations before they were even born. And so who cares about what the people on the ground are doing? It's more important to ask why the people sort of like 15 levels above are making these decisions.
Yeah, we contain multitudes is always my thing. We contain multitudes, but which is Walt Whitman. So, and in that regard, you're absolutely right. This the resonance for me in this movie was the family in the film. Let's talk more about that. You are constantly ping-ponging between thought-provoking and even tear-jerker moments and laughing out loud, like the scene with the academics voting on that. It was just so funny. But the family storyline is what resonated with me the most. Monk and his sister, Tracy Ellis Ross, who is so good.
She's amazing.
I won't say what happens, but she's amazing. The scenes with his brother Clifford, Sterling K. Brown. I love hearing to hear about your inspiration for writing these scenes as a director. You know, you had Jeffrey Wright, Sterling K. Brown, and said Tracy Ellis Ross. What was the dynamic on the set? And I don't want to be remiss in saying Jeffrey and Sterling were nominated for Oscars.
Yeah, they were amazing. So there are some people who say that directing, 90% of directing is casting. That's a quote that I've heard in the past. And I don't know if I fully agree with that, but casting was incredibly important on this movie. And one of the reasons it was incredibly important is because we had no money, which meant we had no time. So we couldn't have rehearsals. We didn't have time for the actors to work together sort of for weeks before we started shooting to really find the scenes and find the characters. We just flew people in. You know, we had Issa for, I think, all of like 4 days, and her schedule was like within an hour. It's like we had to be done and she had to go. And so everybody just had to come onto set and work together. And fortunately, I had these actors who, for whatever reason, had never worked together, but they just bonded immediately and they were sort of able to really find that connection instantly. And I think that what they have told me is that a lot of it was there on the page. They really understood who these people were. They understood the characters on a molecular level, so it felt like they could just come in and do it. And also just the fact that they're just total pros, and everybody just came in, and yes, we had no time, but they knocked it out of the park instantly.
And Leslie Uggams, Leslie fucking
amazing.
So good. Amazing.
How
did you decide on her? I was like, oh my God, it's Leslie Uggams. Where has she been? And please stay, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. No, Leslie is once we got Jeffrey was my first choice. I started reading the novel with Jeffrey in mind. And once we got Jeffrey, I thought, well, for sure our luck has run out. We're not going to get any of the people that we want after this. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, Sterling says yes. Issa says yes. Tracy says yes. And it was like, what? And Leslie says yes. Erica says yes. Like, it was just this sort of like embarrassment of riches as far as the cast goes. And Leslie, we just reached out. And Leslie said that she read the script and felt like, I have to do this. This is something that is worth my time. And she came and was absolute. She was like a true leader on set too. This is a woman who's sung with the Rat Pack in Las Vegas. You know, she's the first Black woman to host a variety show. She's been casting show business checks since she was 4 years old. That's how long she's been doing this. And so when she got to set, she was a true leader on set and really sort of she was out there at 1 a.m. in rain and cold winds shooting her scenes. And Jeffrey Wright said to her, he said, Leslie, you know, do you think you have another take in you? Are you tired? Are you exhausted? And she goes, no, I'm fine. We're shooting a movie. She goes, just remember your lines.
She's a pro. Because she's also playing a character that has a dementia issue, but also is trying to forget, right? She doesn't want to remember things correctly. We talked a little about the depiction of gays in Clifford. He is a total trope, a coming out trope. A gay plastic surgeon sniffing coke on the living room table with a couple of Speedo wearing boys as his life falls apart.
Honestly, I've met that guy.
I know that guy. I know that guy.
I didn't think, well, I'm sure you do, but I actually thought of it as, I didn't think of it as a gay trope. I thought of it as more sort of like a depiction of somebody having a midlife crisis and sort of like if it's a straight guy, he's like getting his ear pierced and dating a 25-year-old and going out and buying a Ferrari for the first time. So I looked at it as more just a guy who has felt like he's 46 and is like trying to really figure out his life now. To be honest, the two people that I empathize with most in the film are Cliff and Monk. And I sort of like really, the way that I wrote Cliff was largely like me, and I'm not gay. It was more just based on my own weirdness.
How do you think about his character compared to Monk, now that you've mentioned that?
I think that he is, so the reason that I really empathize with both of those guys the most is because there was a part of me for a very, so that conversation that he has at the end when he says, you know, I've been thinking a lot about dad dying, not knowing I'm gay. And that makes me sad because he didn't know me entirely. That is the speech that I wish I'd given to myself before my mother died. I grew up in a family. I love my father very much, but my father is a Vietnam veteran who came back with a lot of PTSD. And like a lot of men of his generation, my father came back and he was a stoic. He didn't talk about his feelings. He never sort of like let you in emotionally. My dad was very present. My dad coached my soccer team, helped me with my homework, very, very physically present, but very emotionally distant and gone. And so that's how I grew up. I grew up thinking that it was, you know, not masculine to talk about your feelings. I thought it was embarrassing to show your emotions, embarrassing to let people in. And when my mother died, I realized that there was so much about me that she didn't know, that I never let her know. And it really, really broke my heart. It still breaks my heart. It's still my biggest regret to this day. And so the reason why I really empathize with both those guys is because they're both going through the same thing. They're both sort of like realizing that they've isolated themselves and they've built up a facade in front of themselves and they're not actually who they want to be. And they've been lying to a lot of people in their life for their entire lives. And so
lies are a big part of this movie.
Exactly. And to me,
lying to yourself is
lies and secrets and sort of like deception. And you see where they learned it from their father. Right. And so, to me, Cliff is just like a little bit farther ahead on his journey. Cliff is sort of like seeing, we were raised in the same family. We were raised by the same guy who was great in some ways, but really screwed up in other ways. And I'm trying to teach you that there is a better way. And like, yes, the way that I'm going about it is a little rocky, a little tumultuous, but like I'm figuring out who I want to be and learning to live in that truth. And so to me is sort of the relationship between those two guys.
We'll be back in a minute. Support for this show comes from Ramp. Are you overwhelmed with managing your business expenses, vendor payments, and accounting? Is your finance software just not cutting it? Or maybe you're just looking to cut all that wasteful spending? Ramp could be a total game changer for you and your business. Ramp is the corporate card and spend management software designed to help you save time and put money back in your pocket. Ramp gives finance teams unprecedented control and insight into company spending. With Ramp, you're able to issue cards to every employee with limits and restrictions and automate expense reporting so you can stop wasting time at the end of every month. Plus, Ramp is easy to use. You can get started, issue virtual and physical cards, and start making payments in less than 15 minutes, whether you have 5 employees or 5,000. Not only that, but Ramp can save you money. They estimated that businesses that use Ramp save an average of 5% the first year. And now you can get $250 when you join Ramp. Just go to ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara. Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
last question about the film. It's framed away by the white savior. I mean, the only people who cannot or irredeemable are white people and their cringiness. You start with a scene where a white college student complains he's written the N-word on the board. It ends with a white director, Adam, played by Adam Brody, who is fantastic, greenlighting his film. We won't say how. And the fact that Monk isn't dating a white girl again is a running joke. You don't seem worried about white fragility, which is fantastic, but also doesn't feel like you're playing into white guilt. But it's so, I've also been in those rooms. How are you thinking about white audiences, if at all? And have you been surprised by how well the film has actually been received by white audiences?
So yeah, this was the first time that I just wrote what I wanted to write without considering any audiences, to be honest. This is the first time in my professional career as a screenwriter that I just really didn't give a damn. And I said, I'm just going to make what I want to make. And so I would say that I didn't really think about audience reaction. I thought about what would make the movie the best movie possible. Mm-hmm. That being said, I did want to make a film that sort of, you know, held a mirror up to a lot of the people that I'm surrounded by, a lot of mm-hmm. people in this industry, a lot of people that I know in New York and Los Angeles, and suggest not that they're bad people, because that's the thing. I don't think that they're irredeemable. I don't think that anybody in the film is irredeemable. I don't think anybody in life really is irredeemable. I think that is a wrong way of looking at the world. I think that they are people whose heart is in the right place, who maybe sort of have some things to learn, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have some things to learn, but it doesn't make you a bad person. I think that that's another thing that I want to, you know, I think that one of the reasons why we're so polarized in the world these days is because we sort of have a hard time with nuance and complexity.
Yeah.
And to me, just because somebody harbors some racial prejudice does not make them irredeemable. It does not make them a bad person. I just feel like if you will admit that America is a racist, sexist, homophobic society that has prejudice all the time, if you will admit that, then you have to be okay with people that you know harboring some prejudice when it comes to race and sexuality and gender.
Yeah, I wouldn't talk to half my relatives if that was the case.
Exactly. And so that to me is important.
What it reminded me of is when I went to see Book of Mormon, and it was full of Mormons. And, you know, that's a real dirty theater. That's, you know, it's really eviscerating on Mormons. And the Mormons were like, we love this. And I was like, you know, it's completely mocking you. Or Silicon Valley, where it was completely mocking the tech people. And they're like, isn't that funny? I'm like, they're completely making fun of you. Like, and they wouldn't, like, they did not get it. They thought it wasn't them. I was like, it's about you, because I was a consultant and I was talking about you in specific. So,
but some people have.
Yeah.
We had a screening in New York, mm-hmm. and a white woman after the screening, a white woman, I would say in her 40s or 50s, came up to me after the screening, and she said, that was very uncomfortable for me to watch. She said, I need to tell you that it was actually a little painful for me sometimes mm-hmm. to watch. She said, but I'm really happy that I did, because mm-hmm. there was a lot of sort of like cathartic laughter, A, mm-hmm. but then B, I learned something. And I think that to me is also, I think a lot of people try to avoid feeling uncomfortable. And when I'm watching a piece of art or reading a piece of art and I feel uncomfortable, to me, that's the sign that I should lean in and pay attention more.
You do it through humor. You could do that in an angry way. You know, stop calling me this. But I think humor, everyone sees it. It's like comedy. It's like stand-up comedy when you're like, oh, I see exactly what you're talking about. So I do want to talk a little bit about your career larger in Hollywood and where it's going. In television, you've worked in comedy. Larry Wilmore, who's amazing. I've been on his show. The Good Place, Master of None. You've worked on dramas, Succession, The Watchmen. You won an Emmy for an episode there. That's unusual in television. Do you have a genre preference, or do you just like to switch between them?
Yeah, no, I think that for me, I like stuff that feels real and authentic. And to me, life is neither comedy nor tragedy. I think that one of the reasons why I loved working on Succession was that it is a show that is probably funnier than most of the comedies on television,
it
right?
Is.
But people call it a drama. And so
no,
I think that. Yeah, that's how I feel. And I think that so for me, I think sometimes it's really good to be ignorant. And so I came into this industry incredibly ignorant. And when I started writing on TV, I felt like, oh, all writers, you're just a writer. So you just go and write whatever, right? And it took me like a year or two to realize that a lot of writers just say like, I'm either write drama or I write comedy. And I felt like I don't think you can have one without the other.
This is your directorial debut, too. Did any of the productions prepare you watching people or what? That's a big leap for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I was on set, you know, many times. I was in the edit many times, you know, we're choosing actors and stuff. It clearly sort of like not to the extent which I was for the first film, but I sort of had done this stuff. The thing that was really new to me was like, you know, it's just a lot of the technical stuff. It's like lighting, it's camera lenses, it's working directly with actors to create these characters, right? These were things that I had not done before, but you know, it's on-the-job training, which people don't get enough of these days. And as I was doing it, that list of things that I didn't get, like, started to dwindle, and I started to feel like I understood everything. And so you know, but it's a frustrating thing because by the time you're done with your first movie, you wish you could go back and reshoot the movie because you learned so much and you changed so much.
You seem to have nailed it on the first one, I have to tell you. Now, every week we get a question from an outside expert. I think you'll recognize this voice.
Hey, Kara. Hey, Cord. This is Jesse Armstrong. So I have a question for Cord. Cord, what's the hardest part of making a film? Is it the anxiety of pre-production, the exhaustion of production, the punctured dreams of post-production, or the grind of the promotion and award circuit?
I like that question. Jesse Armstrong is the creator of Succession, which you worked on. So what has been the hardest part for you?
I think that the hardest part for me is the grind of the promotion. I will say that. Mm-hmm. That for me was, I have never been, when I was a kid, I played AYSO soccer, and for whatever reason, they forced us to go sell chocolate bars for our soccer teams to raise funds. And
I've done that.
And they would put me in my damn soccer uniform and then go to the mall to sell chocolate bars. And I hated it. I could never do it. I always stood behind my mother and was just deeply embarrassed and shy. I've just never been a good salesman. I've always been reluctant to do it. And I think that has been the hardest lesson for me is like, I went from making this art project where it's like I worked with a bunch of my friends for years to make something that I really loved and that I'm really proud of. And it's an art project. And then all of a sudden there was this period that I wasn't prepared for where your art project is now a commodity and you need to sell that commodity. And that transitory period was one that's new for me. And look, I don't begrudge it. That's part of the job. It was part of the job that I wasn't prepared for. And that to me was the most difficult thing.
You have to smile a lot, Cord. So before we go, I know you've got to go soon. I want to talk about Hollywood and the industry very briefly. The streaming services are really in the crosshairs this past summer when writers and actors went on strike, trying to get a bigger cut, more residuals, but also to protect themselves against AI taking over your jobs. Now that it's, you know, I know a lot of my friends are in the industry and they are still shook up. A lot of deals got cut, et cetera, et cetera. How do you feel it is right now? And do you think the deal they negotiated was strong enough?
Yeah, look, everybody worked really, really hard and a lot of people sacrificed a ton. Our guilds worked tirelessly for us. And a lot of people, as you said, lost their deals. I have people who sort of are struggling to pay rent. I've heard of people who had to sell their homes. So a lot of people sacrificed a lot for these deals. Obviously, everybody wishes that you could have gotten more. That's sort of like what a deal is, right? You make a deal, you have to make some concessions and not get everything you want. But I think we made the strongest deal possible this time around. That being said, I think that this is a fight that's going to continue. We understand what we're up against, and we're up against an industry that is trying to sort of, you know, I don't think that the AI stuff is going to go away. I don't think that sort of like them trying to cut corners as much as possible is going to go away. I think that we're going to have to continue to remain vigilant and fight as much as possible. But I'm wondering how much you think this is, because I have a theory that a lot of this has to do with the influence of tech on the industry.
Oh, and yes, sort of I've just like written a book. It's coming out the 27th.
Oh, are you serious?
Yes, it's called Burn Book. It's not very nice to the people of tech.
I'm fine with that, but yeah, please do. But that to me
have
is
have you thought about ChatGPT or any other generative AI programs? Now, your movie's distributed through Amazon MGM Studios, for example. Do you think about all these intersections? There's tools like Pickaxe where you can generate scenes by describing characters and plot. Do you ever ever think that you will be using these, or are you nervous about them?
No, I don't. I'm sort of like the John Henry in all of this. I sort of like figure that I'm gonna sort of like have my hammer and just sort of like bang and bang and bang. And maybe I die at the end of it, but I'm still John Henry.
He dies.
Yeah, he does.
Plot twist. plot spoiler.
Look, if these tools end up being helpful for creativity, then I'm all for it. I really find it dispiriting that somebody would want to write an entire script that way. That to me is sort of takes the fun out of it almost. So I literally have never used ChatGPT. I've never used an AI program. I've never fiddled with it. And I think that worrying about it and stressing about it is sort of exactly the wrong thing to do. The world marches on, and sort of you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube at this point. And so the best thing you can do is make
you need
good
to
work.
It's like saying I'm not using this internet thing, you know, back in the 90s. One of the things, I'll have two more questions. AI has some notorious biases, including anti-black biases, again, creating those
surprise,
tropes.
Surprise.
There's a very famous tech expression, it's very technical, which is crap in, crap out. Are you concerned about that? Or do you just, it's not going to affect you. You're going to go the full creative methodology of how you've been operating.
Yeah, no, this is the thing. I'm concerned about the biases in tech, of course, because especially as it pertains to police and, mm-hmm. the sort of like justice system. I think that is where it really frightens me. But yeah, I think that you have to look at the prejudices of the people making the stuff. And if these mm-hmm. people are prejudiced who are making the stuff and these people are, as you said, crap in, crap out, then you need to be prepared for that. And so, again, I think that the idea that our salvation lies in technology is slowly going away. Hopefully people mm-hmm. are realizing that these things are not going to save us and save the world. And generally, the idea that just because something's new means it's great and benevolent and going to help us is hopefully people are realizing that that's not the case all the time.
Absolutely. So I guess my final question is, when you think about that, where it's going, it's been a very unsettling time. But these movies are all doing very well. You know, you just saw the Grammys, very full of energy and very oddly diverse for a second and a half, and in a natural, comfortable way, it was really just great. It was just great. What's your dream? Obviously, you want to win an Oscar. That would be great for your career. But is there a thing you want to work on now that's touched you the same way this book did?
Yeah, I'm writing three different movies right now. They're all original screenplays. I'm writing two different TV series right now that are adaptations of stuff. And so I just want to keep making stuff. That to me is mm-hmm. sort of the key. I just want to keep, people ask me if I'm addicted to directing now, and it's like, yeah, I want to keep directing, but I just want to keep making art. That's all. I don't distinguish between stage plays or films or television shows or whatever. I just want to keep making art. That's my dream, is just that people keep letting me make stuff.
Is there someone who gives a preview of the topic area? You're going to go medieval or something.
I don't know. Well, I'm zagging a little bit. The two screenplays that are most close to being finished right now are an erotic thriller and a Western, a contemporary Western film, neo-noir Western, dealing with some similar themes of what we're dealing with in American Fiction, but through a much different lens.
Wow, fantastic. I'm sure they'll be great. Cord, I couldn't be more happy for someone. You are such a hard worker, and not just that, just plugging away. And this movie is very special. I urge everybody to see it.
Thank you so much.
I don't say that a lot, although there's a lot of great movies this year. There's a lot you're competing against. It's really high quality.
Yeah, there's some good stuff. There's some good stuff. It's great to be amongst the good company.
Really good stuff. And good luck at the Oscars. I'm not going to ask what you're wearing, but, what are you wearing?
I don't even know yet. Overalls.
Armani. Oh, no, don't do that.
Armani overalls.
Don't do Billie Eilish. Don't do Billie Eilish. You go. Just don't. In any case, Cord, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. Spectacular debut for the director.
Thank you so much. It means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
On with Kara Swisher is produced by Naeem Araza, Christian Castro-Rossell, Kateri Yoakum, Megan Cunane, Megan Burney, and Michael McDowell. Special thanks to Mary Mathis, Kate Gallagher, and Andrea Lopez-Grisado. Our engineers are Fernando Aruda and Rick Kwan. Our theme music is by Trackademics. If you're already following the show, you get to meet Leslie Uggams. Oh, I'd be so lucky. If not, overalls to the Oscars. Go wherever you listen to podcasts, search for On with Kara Swisher, and hit follow. Thanks for listening to On with Kara Swisher from New York Magazine, the Vox Media Podcast Network, and us. You can subscribe to the magazine at nymag.com/pod. We'll be back on Monday with more.